Well, hey, everyone, we made it. Yep, we're all here on this historical week, a time period that's going to be talked about in future textbooks and Ken Burns documentaries, and we finally made it. No, I'm not talking about the U.S. presidential election. I'm talking about the new Mr. Bungle record. The Raging Wrath of the Easter Bunny, the first Mr. Bungle music, was released after over 20 years of waiting. Lots of excitement all around the world. It's been all across social media. Lots of press and interviews. I think even Jason Momoa shared a picture of the new Bungle release on Instagram. So it's been a wonderful week for Mr. Bungle fans. And of course, I am one of them. I am absolutely excited and glad to finally have my vinyl copy of that album. However, it's important to note that Mr. Bungle consists of five extremely talented musicians, both then and now. And with the sheer brilliance of Trey Spruance and Trevor Dunn, and of course the amazing Mike Patton, it can be easy to overlook the contributions of other members, like Danny Heifetz and Bear McKinnon, who are also on that same level of brilliance. And in recent years, I've sought out the post-Bungle recordings of all the members. Secret Chiefs 3, anything Trevor Dunn's done, all the Mike Patton stuff, I'm already on board. And that also goes for Bear McKinnon. And I've been totally blown away by the wonderfulness that is Bear McKinnon's band, Umlaut. And you could check them out too, umlautbearmckinnon.bandcamp.com. And to me, the music of Umlaut really showcases the beauty and the musical daringness that drew me into Mr. Bungle's music in the first place. The irreverence, the spirit, the dexterity is there. And guess what? Today, we are going to talk about the new Umlaut record, an extremely limited vinyl 7-inch. So grab a pen and mark this date on your calendars or set a phone alert. The new Umlaut record goes on sale Friday, November 6th at umlautbearmckinnon.bandcamp.com. Now, for those of you who are pretty hardcore into Mr. Bungle, you probably already know that both Danny and Bear now live in Australia. Right here, they are my fellow countrymen, and I hoped one day we could have an in-person interview. However, COVID pretty much stopped that from happening for the foreseeable future, especially since Bear is located in Melbourne, which has recently been under one of the most severe COVID lockdowns in all of the world. I mean, we're talking mandatory face masks, $1,000 plus fines for breaking curfew. It hasn't been easy for the Melburnians in 2020. However, it has been handy for extra band practice and projects like this new Umlaut 7-inch single. Now, again, it's being released on Friday, November 6th, which, if you don't know, is Bandcamp Friday. And that's when 100% of all proceeds of all sales go directly to the artist. Bandcamp doesn't take a cut of the money on Bandcamp Friday, which makes Friday, November 6th a no-brainer for Bungle fans, record nerds, and anyone who appreciates interesting and unique music. Now today, Bear and I discuss the single, as well as deep dive into the history of Mr. Bungle, the years since, and much, much more. By the way, we have a full extended interview available to our Patreon community at patreon.com/vinylguide. I'm always putting extended interviews up there, extra stuff to listen to, secret episodes, and more. So if you want to hear more of this conversation and help support this podcast, go to patreon.com/vinylguide. And before we start, just a big shout out to our show sponsor, Groove Washer, the best damn record cleaner in the world. You're not going to get a better record cleaner than the Groove Washer. Ask for it by name at your local record shop or go to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10. You'll get 10% off everything at groovewasher.com. So go there now, groovewasher.com, enter VINYLGUIDE10 at checkout and clean your records, people. And we'd also like to thank our friends at audiophileusa.com, the family-owned and operated online record shop that only sells excellent and near-mint vinyl records. No subjective ratings, just the best, the cleanest, the most pristine records, some ex-store stock, some still in original shrink wrap, and they ship to you no matter where you are in the world. Chicago, No worries. Florida, not a problem. Budapest, yep, they ship there too. Sydney, Tokyo, or Cleveland, AudiophileUSA.com will send you those records, no problem. Head over to AudiophileUSA.com, search for yourself, and find your holy grail. And if you enjoy this episode and or Mr. Bungle, then check out these other interviews we've had on past episodes of The Vinyl Guide, including episode 243 featuring Dave Lombardo talking about Mr. Bungle coming together with it, recording the album, touring with them, and more. Of course, he also talks about his time with the Misfits and Slayer as well. That's episode 243 of The Vinyl Guide. Trey Spruance was on our show, episodes 180 and 181 of The Vinyl Guide. Trey went in-depth in the Bungle years to the point to where those episodes are often cited as providing some of the most detailed recollections of the Bungle era up until then. So those are episodes 180 and 181 featuring Trey Spruance talking Mr. Bungle. Of course, Greg Workman, co-founder of Ipecac Records, was on our show, episode 167. That's where they originally dropped the hint that there was going to be more Bungle in the future. So check it out, episode 167 of The Vinyl Guide. Former Bungle manager Kristen Yee was on our show, episode 175 of The Vinyl Guide. And of course, Scott Ian of Anthrax and Moonlighting with Mr. Bungle, episode 139 of The Vinyl Guide. You can find these episodes and more up on our website, thevinylguide.com. Or of course, you could check out Apple Music, Spotify, Stitcher, Sonnet, or wherever you get your podcasts. And with the upfronts done, let's turn our attention towards Melbourne, Australia, and our conversation with Umlaut Bear McKinnon.
Hola.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
Hey, how you going?
Hey, you don't sound Australian.
Yeah, I've had that thing. I was actually, because I hear you, your accent, and then I'm like, or our accent maybe, and then it's like, I was like, wait a minute. And then I knew that you were based in Sydney, and my mind sort of races. I'm like, shit, how did he get stuck?
So let's start there. How did you wind up in Australia?
I don't know. I think there was this van that pulled up. Basically, an Aussie girl kind of, I don't know, what's the diplomatic word? No, I met an Aussie girl back. I actually met an Aussie girl on a Secret Chiefs tour back in 98. It was, I think it was the first Secret Chiefs kind of stint. And then, and it wasn't a classic groupie kind of situation because people were like, ah, yeah, he would just, it was like, no, no, no. It was very much more innocent than that. But, and the next thing you know, we stay in touch, and then I'm able to bring her over to California for a short visit. And then, you know, one thing leads to another. Next thing you know, you've got two grown young men walking around with dual citizenship, and my kids, our kids, we're not together anymore, but, but here I am. And then it's like, the next thing you know, it's like whatever, 20 years, upwards of 20 years later.
Do you think you'll ever go back?
I don't know. It's a good question. It's a good question. I don't know. It's hard to say. Yeah.
Like, you haven't made up your mind whether you're going to move back or not. You're still up in the air about that. Would you want to go back?
Not at this point, but I mean, it's funny because it's like, no, I don't know. It's hard to say. And I don't, it's funny. My mom, you know, from Germany, when she came over to California, I think, or actually it was probably Texas. I think she met my dad in maybe the late 50s. And then it was like this thing of, she said one of these things. She's like, you know, Barry, you stay away from your home country long enough and pretty soon you don't belong anywhere. And I was just like, oh, mom, like, what kind of a thing to say is that? Like, it's, you know, it's just so like, I do sympathize with that thing of like, cause there's a little bit of that feeling of kind of like, if I went back to California, I'd be sort of like, okay, now what, you know, but I don't know. And then I get so many people going like, oh, you got to bring your band to the States and this and that and all this kind of thing. And it's like, oh, I would love to do that, you know? And then I know there'd be a lot of people that would come out maybe if, you know, in this prior world we were living in where you could actually still do shows, you know, but, Yeah, that is sort of like would be a great thing to be able to do, but I don't know.
Melbourne's so cool. You don't. I mean, really, it's gonna be hard to beat that experience.
I could do worse. I could really do worse than being here. It's always surprising, like how many amazing musicians and cool little places there are here. Mm. Yeah, I do. I guess from California, I do miss the pristine sort of river kind of experience that you can get over there in the Smith River in Northern California and places like that. Definitely.
Where were you raised at in California?
Crescent City, which is like kind of just south of the Oregon border, kind of maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes south of the Oregon border. So it's like an hour north of give or take than Arcata, Eureka, where the Bungle guys, where I met those guys. So it's sort of the same thing, but just further north.
Now, growing up in a city like that, I mean, it sounds like it's probably pretty far away from these central hubs.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you find the sort of avant-garde music that really seemed to spark your interest?
Well, you don't, basically. Well, actually, I'm trying to think. There was like a Southern Oregon, probably in Ashland. There was some college radio station that we were listening to that had like stuff like Dr. Demento and I don't know if you're familiar with that. It was like a radio show, this kind of radio show.
We've had the doctor on the show.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So yeah, they had like Dr. Demento stuff on there. And I remember hearing like, you know, kind of electric jazz and stuff on this radio station. That was sort of the inroad. And then KHSU, which is, you know, Arcata. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where you would hear these kinds of things. And in fact, one of my long old best friends, whatever, Ed Cole, who lives up in Vancouver, is like a really avid like record collector. And, you know, I mean, he was the guy that had the record collection and was listening to like No Means No and all these great and Dead Milkmen, the Meat Puppets, things like this, always on vinyl. And it was always like, wow, this is a special breed of person that's buying this and has that, you know, and listens. And it's always this, like, there's nothing that compares to that, the crackle of that. But I guess it's like the avant-garde really out there kind of stuff. I wasn't really even aware of until I was at university in like mid 1988 and, you know, kind of very quickly met the Bungle guys there, or at least Trevor and Trey. I was actually put in a jazz quartet, assigned to a jazz quartet with those two on drums. Mm. At the time I was sort of playing more drums, and I think I just was so just like loud and obnoxious with my audition that he was like, oh, I'll put this guy with these other two kind of, you know, characters, you know, like it was weird. Cause that was actually the way I met those guys. I remember when it was with some other students who were looking at the assignments of like, oh, what kind of, which quartet, which players are you getting set up with? And this guy was like, oh man, you got Trevor and Trey. No way, dude. And I was like, who are these guys? You know, I had no idea who they were at that point. Mm-hmm. So then my world kind of was opening up like very quickly with that the experience of just meeting those guys and being at university with those guys. Yeah.
So at that point, Bungle had been together for several years, several demo tapes.
Right.
So when you got thrown in together with them, was it right off the bat that you were getting along with them musically and personality?
Well, it wasn't really obvious right away. In fact, I was, cause I'm always kind of like, you know, never giving myself credit or whatever. And then I didn't really have any experience, but I had one chance that I would have been able to see those guys. I think they were opening up for the Meat Puppets. That's right. My friend Ed had gone to see, was like, hey, I'm going down to Humboldt to see the Meat Puppets. Do you want to go? And I sort of opted out. It was right in the middle of the week. It was a Wednesday night. And I was like, nah, that's cool. And then he comes back after the thing. He was like, it was amazing. The bass player was like falling down, but still playing these insanely intricate bass lines. And they were like throwing like hamburger hot dogs into the crowd and all this kind of thing. And then they finish off with a dog pile at the end. And I was like, he's taking all these great photos of it. And that was like the one chance I would have been able to see that band from the outside. And I was just like kicking myself for all these years, like going, oh, I would have loved to see that as an audience member. Cause I remember Trevor even threatening me. He's like, oh man, you're not going to know what hit you like to do some of these gigs when they eventually needed a horn player and they asked me to be in there. And I was like, I was so, you know, just kind of self-efficacy. And I'm just like, I don't know, guys, I'll give it a try. I'll try it out. You know?
Now, when you joined, or at least the first recording you did, OU818.
Right.
At that point, did you feel like a full member? I mean, they've been going for some time. So did you feel like you were contributing to and deserve that 1/5, or were you still kind of feeling a little bit, that's their group and I'm just kind of playing with them?
I still felt like it was a little bit their group and I'm trying to, you know what I mean? I was trying to kind of like earn my stars or whatever, or stripes. Sorry. Whoops. Sorry about
you
that.
You can earn both of them if you want.
It's an election. It's an election year, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll be back after these. That's terrible. No, I do have this horrible thing of referring to them as those guys and you guys, you know, Trevor. And it's funny because even like later on, like Trevor, when he was sending me his demos for, I think, Disco Volante, around the Disco Volante era, he like when he gave me the tape of like the ideas we had going around, he titled the cassette, "You're in This Band." Because he was like, you know, because I was just like, I was going, "Oh, you guys," and you referring to you guys all the time, because it did feel a bit like a special club, and I was just sort of like the horn player coming in there. But they were always so like very supportive and trying to, you know, kind of go like, you know. And then even like around the time of Disco Volante, I think they titled the cassette that I had of my ideas to them, like Mike, I think he said something like, "Bear brings it," you know, like kind of like finally he's like trying to kind of like, you know. So anyway, yeah, it was right.
Most of that first album was somewhat written when you joined, is that right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So Disco Volante was your first opportunity to really contribute, and they wanted you to contribute, it sounds like.
Yeah, they were always kind of, you know, and then, or they'd hear me sort of, you know, muck around on a keyboard and then be very encouraging and trying to kind of get that, you know, happening more for me, just making it, letting me know that like, yeah, man, come on. What do you got kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But those are such strong personalities, those guys. And so I guess I was a little intimidated, and they're a little bit older than me. And so it was like that had a little bit of a bigger brother, older brother kind of dynamic, and me being like a middle child. That's been a bit of an Achilles heel for me, if that's the right term. But man, I tell you what, man, I'm ready to throw my weight around now. No, it's not yet.
I'm drunk with power now. So when you joined, you did this OU818 demo. And that seems to be like it was preparation for the self-titled album. Did you guys know a record deal was coming? Was that kind of already in the works when you recorded that?
I don't know. I guess maybe they, I'm doing it again. Maybe they had a better idea of it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess I did have a feeling that I didn't really know about record deal so much, but I did know that it was like, it was always this kind of excitement of like, man, cannot wait to play this, such great songs and so much fun and just like the most talented musicians I'd ever been able to kind of play with. So I was just like, I always had this feeling of like, man, I cannot wait to get, you know, to unleash these or be just playing these songs live, you know? Because it was always just like instant like mosh pit and then like the entire room like pogoing, you know, playing stuff like Squeeze Me Macaroni and whatever. It was just, there was a real, and then, you know, and then I remember Trey kind of talking to me about like Faith No More, because Mike was away with Faith No More, I think, when I was first kind of getting drafted into the group. I remember we went on like a long drive and Trey was like playing the real thing in the car on probably cassette or something. It's like, man, listen to this drummer, man. You know, doing these kinds of things. So just like, we were sort of, you know, just, and then, so there was this kind of, there was also this mystique of like, wait, who's this singer, man? And whatever. And then like, I hadn't met him quite yet, but you know, I was in that thing with that quartet with Trey and Trevor. Okay. Yeah.
So when you connected with them at school, you were working with them on music, but this mysterious singer was already off on tour.
Right. I'm not even sure what the timeline is of what he was doing, or maybe he was recording the real thing with them or whatever. He had gone off to do the thing. And so there was this kind of, it was an interesting kind of like world to be in. And then, but you know, Trey's kind of going like, oh man, you're not going to believe how hard this drummer hits the drums and everything else, you know? And of course we all know, you know, how amazing Puffy is and Borden and whatever, and what a huge part of that, the Faith No More sort of sound, him and Billy absolutely, you know, have. So yeah. So there was just this kind of thing. There was sort of this mystique and you kind of like, whoa, and just kind of this wide eyed kid of like, okay, let's try this. And Trevor bringing all these like, just immaculately kind of written charts of the horn lines for me. It wasn't kind of like, yeah, just here's the thing and go learn it by ear or whatever. It was kind of like these parts were already written out, and Trevor has such a beautiful hand. I don't know if you've ever seen it. The way he writes out, you know, notation is just so just impeccable. Yeah. Oh. Just beautiful. It's like, it's a, yeah.
So tell me about the first time you finally got to meet Mike. What was your first impression? What was your first interaction with him like?
Terror. It was just terror. I remember it was like, he had one of these, like, what do you call them? Those, I think they're like these fanny packs, but of course it was, he's wearing it in the front, and he had his long hair and the Lakers hat sideways and whatever. And it was actually in a rehearsal room on campus at HSU. And I was just like, I remember Trevor even putting me on the phone with him, and I was just like, you're already kind of like hearing these stories of the guy, and then hearing, you know, his just insane natural ability. And so I was very intimidated. I remember Trevor was like, put me on the phone. He's like, talk to the singer, man. And he's like, puts me on the phone. So I'm like, hi. And he's, I didn't even know what he looked like. I didn't have any kind of thing. It's like nowadays you can go, like, you know, look up this archival footage and see, like, oh yeah, I can see this band, what they look like a little bit. You get an idea. And I just had no idea. Mm. And then when I met him, it was basically at a rehearsal. It was kind of like we were getting ready to, I don't even know what the first gig was. I feel like the first gig was a Dead Milkman thing at Gurneyville. Anyway. So it was like, he just showed up. Like I literally met him at a rehearsal. Or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he had this whole kind of thing, and there wasn't like a PA there. He was just sort of sitting there. I remember just kind of like, he's just kind of sitting there like, you know, like, yeah, I have a vague recollection of just like, who is this dude and what the F? And he just looked like a kind of a ragamuffin kind of, like, you know, kid just from the, but like with the long hair and just had the, like, mm-hmm. the Air Jordans on. It was just like this kind of like, you know,
Patton has this, like, supernatural ability, and his voice, I don't know how many octaves, I saw something, it was like 6 octaves and some change or whatever.
Right.
Did he take special care of his voice? did he do any routines or any sort of things, ablutions maybe, to preserve his voice?
No, not as far as I knew. And that's it's funny. I mean, if we asked him at the time, he might be like, he might have a better answer, but it's like, I think on the OU818 demo, there's like, he had like a fisherman's friend, which is kind of like a, you know, a warming lozenge, and which he spits out kind of famously before, at the beginning of, like, Slowly Growing Deaf, I think. And then I think that's even in the lyric sheet. Like, it was like actually in the lyric sheet, like he spits out this thing right before he starts the vocal take or whatever that was on the, mm-hmm. But no, that's the strange thing. And he never had done any kind of warm-ups, but I'm sure he probably has, you know, at this point he would be like, yeah, I do this thing, or I'm like, I know what works better to kind of take care of it. And I'm sure he's well educated on that. But at the time, no, it was just kind of like, and that's the other thing, is when it is also his speaking voice, you wouldn't, what do they say? What is the word? It doesn't betray what an insane instrument, natural instrument that is on that dude. Right.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where you hear him and you just sort of like, huh. And then, like, you mean there's other people that you kind of come into contact with, and you have an amazing voice as well. I've got to say, like, as I listen back to some of these episodes, I was listening to the Billy Gould episode just before we came on today. And he was talking about, you guys are talking about instrumental music and how you were, and even the, but anyway, like I've got, like, say, people, like, coworkers, and they might have the kind of like a less powerful kind of resonating voice, you know, and he might be like a 6.5 foot tall dude, and he's got this kind of like almost Muppet sounding kind of voice. And you're like, what happened?
Actually, yeah. That's probably one of the reasons why I wound up in Australia. When I was traveling around and I met this girl from Australia, we exchanged phone numbers, and then we spent weeks and sometimes months just calling each other. So she really knew me from my voice.
Wow.
Rather than having to look at me in the face. I think if she had to look at me in the face, maybe it would have turned out a lot different.
Oh, that's funny. I think it's, well, you do have a beautiful resonating voice. And I was just like, wow. And then it's formidable. Mm. And it's also like, I was talking to Gene, I was like, man, this guy, like, what a voice on this guy. It's like, it sounds. And so there's a little bit of intimidation, a little bit of kind of butterflies, as even myself going into this interview, kind of like, seeing the people that you've talked to. I saw you just spoke to Lombardo recently. Mm-hmm. And it's just,
you're
like,
making me blush. So you guys start pumping out these demo tapes, OU818. And right. I remember in the Bay Area, because that's where I grew up, San Jose, Santa Cruz area. Okay. I remember the tapes made their way down there. Yeah. Do you recall like how those tapes were created, how many were made, and like how they manifested?
Not exactly. I'm notorious for, you know, just keep my eye on the music side of things. Mm-hmm. And as far as just like the nuts and bolts of what I'm doing and daily practice or whatever. And like, you know, Trevor was definitely, you know, the manager, acting manager, kind of like liaison or whatever person at that point. So I wasn't really sure of like the production of the things I just, but it was always very cool to have the thing in your hand. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wasn't sort of like paying really close attention. That seems to be a recurring theme for me, is like people are like, what was it like with Trey and how does he do all this? And I'm like, I wish I'd paid attention. You know, it's like people like, because he is, you know, such a legendary producer and an engineer that it's just like, I mean, you hear these Secret Chiefs recordings, you're like, how the did he get that 3D effect where that thing is flying in from your upper left hand, you know, shoulder, and then like this other thing's like swooping up from over there, and it's like the mixing and that whole kind of thing it's never been lost on me of his stamp that is on these Bungle recordings, and you know, especially on Disco Volante and in California, it was just like, mm-hmm. wow, you know, like. Anyway,
with each Bungle release, there always seemed to be a bit of a theme. The self-titled is a bit of a kind of a dark carnival. Uh-huh. Disco Volante, God, I'd hate to even try to characterize it. California was like a psychotic Beach Boys. Did you guys talk about the themes or the direction of the record before you went into it? Or was it just like you kind of looked back and said, oh, that's what came together?
I think it's more of an afterthought. Yeah, it was more of an afterthought. I remember it was like, it's usually something is coming forward and then it's more of like, oh, so this is kind of what's coming together. And here it is. It is, you know, it's kind of like even now, like we could sit there and like open and close our hand in front of our face and but we wouldn't be able to tell you each other, like literally how we're doing it. And the fact that it's so quickly lost on us, like, wow, I can just open and close my hand in front of my face. It's like, it is that sort of this afterthought or this kind of like, whoa, okay, this is what's happening. Or yeah, there's this kind of doo-wop, this psychotic doo-wop thing happening. Or yeah, it was like, there was, I think even Air Conditioned Nightmare, for example, was always on the set lists as Beach Boys. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's something like, oh, this is kind of what's coming out. It's never been a like, all right, let's do some kind of game plan of what we're trying to do here. It's more like, this is what we're coming out with. And then here's your part kind of thing. Yeah. Mm.
Okay. Because Greg Workman was on the show, and I think he mentioned something, the fact of the fourth Bungle, or at least the demos for what would have been the fourth Bungle, reminded him of Devo. It was going in that sort of direction. But I don't know. Do you remember anything that was
which is the fourth? I'm sorry.
Well, it's the one you guys didn't make. It was the after California. Apparently, there were some demos that were of the direction he described it, the direction of a Devo like concept.
Huh? Yeah, I don't know. I think it's interesting because again, it's like it's more we're trying to fit into a thing where even with Umlaut, my Melbourne band here, it was more like. People are like, oh, so what kind of music is it? And I'm like, I don't know. I think of it as kind of like instrumental pop music, really.
It's fucking wonderful music, man.
Thanks so much.
No, you know what? I was talking to a friend of mine the other night, and I was just saying, you know, Umlaut, the solo stuff that Bear's been doing, that just, it pops out like the secret sauce. Like some of the stuff I absolutely love from those Bungle records, I'm like, fuck, here it is concentrated.
Yeah, I do appreciate that. That's yeah. It's funny because like the one of the real, I don't know if tragedy is maybe too strong a word, but is, or the regrets that I have that is that like, I really kind of came into my own when I was, you know, waiting for my first kid to be born, and which was basically immediately after that last California European tour, which was in, I think, 2000, maybe, you know, August to go into September, maybe even if I'm probably wrong about that, people would be like, Bear, you don't even know when the thing, but it was like, yeah. So I was really coming into my own in the few years when my first kid was very young and whatever. And that was what basically came into fruition with the first Umlaut thing, which was a total boon that we got Mike to sort of contribute vocals for Atlas Face. But it was like, so a lot of the, all that stuff, it would have been stuff I would have, you know, happily put forward to a Mr. Bungle thing if that were the thing, you know, to be, they would have been like, okay, Barrett's too many ideas or something, you know. Mm-hmm. But whereas in the past it was sort of like, you know, I'd have like one or two ideas, you know, and then they might find their way in some of the Mr. Bungle music.
So that's interesting. You said that you were coming into your own as your first child was being born. Was there a correlation there, or did it just happen? That's where you were at, and that's what was happening for you.
I guess a little bit. It was also just kind of this like the salad days of like I came into Australia on a tourist visa for 6 months just after that last tour finished, and then it was just like we were in Sydney there in Tamarama, which is, as you know, just like south of Bondi Beach, and it was just this kind of I had nothing but time on my hands really just to wait for Kyle to be born. And then so there's just a lot of time sitting around, you know, and then I'm sitting here with this inbuilt six track on this Yamaha keyboard, which is the bane of my fellow musicians around me to this day. They're like, you still have a version of that keyboard? What the hell? They get so frustrated with me. But it was just like a really quick, easy way to write, to put little ideas together. And I don't know. It was just something that maybe I'm sort of a late bloomer, and stuff was just sort of, it was just like a perfect storm of like waiting around, really in love with my kid's mom at the time. And then there it is, you know, and then just, yeah, it's just kind of like watching. And then just the dawning of having a kid, it sort of like dawning on me of just like, oh no, oh wow, this is crazy. This is such a transformative time. And it's also a terrifying time because you're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
What am I going to do? How do you do this? And then very quickly, like my childhood just like is over very quickly. Of course I was, you know, I was 30, I think at the time. So it was just like, I hadn't really done so much compositionally or ideas wise as up to the point where, you know, Mr. Bungle kind of has this unceremonious, not real kind of like, I don't even know what. It was just like kind of ended on a sour note, to say the least, at the end of that European tour, which is a whole other thing. But then you're just kind of like, ah, and then I'm going to have a kid. And then now I'm off in this foreign country. For me, it's not really that foreign. I mean, for Americans, come on, it's about as easy a kind of transition as you could make. but it's like, it was just a very heady time, but also just a very kind of magical time where it's just like, oh wow. And that's where it sort of kind of burns me a little bit, where I'm like, oh man, I was finally kind of really coming into my own, just as being able to get my ideas and just forming my ideas really. And just kind of being like, oh wow, I can do this with a melody. I can do this with an interesting chord progression. Like this melody sort of works over these chords and then maybe not so much. And then trying different experiments with kind of putting, you know, like, or taking a melody, like one melody and then coming up with three different like possible chord progressions that could go under that same melody, and the way those notes change as far as chord tones, as far as being like nines or sixes or fives or sevens or whatever, like as far as like, anyway, so it was just like this whole kind of very experimental time for me as far as really coming into my own. And then of course there wasn't anywhere to put it as far as like with Mr. Bungle and, mm-hmm. you know, I still dream of like of bringing strong ideas to those guys, but it's hard to say, you know, because again, it's like going back to that thing of like, so were you guys really planning on doing this kind of thing with the band? And it's like, it was always an organic thing where it was kind of like something happens where there's like somebody has a good idea and then it speaks to another person and then it kind of gets a bit of momentum. But it's always kind of like you sort of look back at like, what is this? It seems to be forming into this, you know. It's never kind of so much as a real intention going in. But yeah. So with Umlaut, it was always, it became this thing of like, oh wow, this is such amazing kind of pool of musicians here in Melbourne and to draw upon. And then these kids were sort of maybe starstruck with me as by association. And so they were like, there was literally like a band was assembled and almost like rehearsed up. And then it was like, hey, Bear, I met this guy, Mark Turner, who's a VCA guitarist. And he just basically assembled a band. And then the next thing you know, he was like, yeah, I've got like, da da da, we'll play drums and bass and da da da. And then we just show up. And then I'm at a rehearsal, basically learning my own ideas and bringing them to life. But Pete, there was such a great pool of people to sort of draw on here that it literally formed underneath me. And then I was like showing up and I'm like, okay, let's see what this sounds like. And then we're off and running. Yeah.
The level of culture and musicianship in Melbourne is off the chart. I mean, my wife, she's an interior decorator, and okay. she described the difference between Sydney and Melbourne to me like this. She said, in Sydney, you've got the nice weather, you've got the views, you've got the beaches, and people design their lives around going outside and, you know, the view and the beauty and that sort of thing. In Melbourne, the weather's unpredictable. A lot of times it's cold. Right. People design their lifestyles around being inside. That, therefore, you get a lot more bookshops, you get a lot more record stores. And
interesting.
These maniac musicians that practice, you know, 8 and 12 hours a day. Yeah, Melbourne is a ground zero for fantastic musicianship. You're in the right place, man.
Yeah, there's definitely really amazing players here. Angus Leslie from Umla and Sex on Toast, my guitar player, like kind of right-hand man producer. He's amazing, as is Shane Lieber and Rama, the drummer. Rama Perwada, the drummer. He's like, so it's like, and it's also can be kind of like intimidating where you go out and you're like, and then it's just like, wow, these guys, this is definitely a world-class kind of city. And it's funny because I was just thinking when you mentioned the weather, I was thinking about how like I almost kind of get like giddy when I have like a day off and it's a bad weather day. I'm like, well, I'm definitely not missing anything. You know, there's nowhere to go. It's just going to be this cold rain or whatever, but which can very quickly change into like scorching kind of afternoon heat and sun tanning weather, you know, of course. But definitely amazing players here, and even Justin Marshall.
So tell me about this record. Tell me about this 45. So now this is going up for sale on your Bandcamp, which I believe is umlautbearmckinnon.bandcamp.com, and it's going up November 6th. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, this is like this was mastered by Adam Dempsey, and we wanted to use Zenith because they make beautiful records, and we felt it was important to use a Melbourne company. But it's everything to do with, and we can't play gigs, so we're trying to kind of make, you know, interesting artifacts, and just for people that are into us, and it's such a, you know, such a cool idea to have our music on vinyl. And and I think going forward, we're going to be looking at more kind of vinyl type releases, just because it's such a cool thing. And I'm one of these shocking people that doesn't have, you know, a record collection, much less a record player. But it's just like, you know, I feel like I could definitely be probably changing that tune. Yeah.
No one's judging you. That's okay. It's all right. It's all right, man.
I know we're in
you're making the music. It's fine. You're on your own thing. Yeah. You have your own madness. You're working.
That's it. I thought it was really interesting when you were talking with Billy Gould about like instrumental music and like how you can, and the idea of how you were mentioning something about how powerful, you know, instrumental music with no lyrics, you know, and what that means for you. And that really resonated with me. I was like, oh, wow. Cause I'm actually living that right now with a piece of music I'm working on that one of the Bungle guys has contributed to so far. He's actually, well, I guess he's sort of a neighbor of yours there in Sydney. Danny's put drums on this track that I've been working on, and I've just been doing some vocals on it, and it's all just kind of non-lyric like vocals going on it so far. And then I was like having this real like dilemma. I was like, oh no, it's like, because I was really wanting to feel like, okay, this is finished, and this is really, I'm really excited to kind of share this with the world and whatever. Possibly also through the High Castle Tell Orchestra, which is this project that I've been working on with Tim Smolens from Astratosphere, who is like very instrumental in the kind of the architecture of behind the scenes with Trey, with programming of these keyboards and a lot of, you know, just engineering sides of California. He's the bass player from Astratosphere. Yeah. Anyway, we've got this other project called the High Castle Tell Orchestra, which is getting ready to kind of launch a bunch of singles and t-shirts and vinyl and other things. And it's just like amazing, amazing music and amazing players. This German accordionist named Stian, he was like, it's just bonkers how accomplished this guy is. Because like, you know, in the wake of this rest in peace, Eddie Van Halen passing, it's like, he strikes me as like an accordion player who has, like, if he was like a reincarnation of Charlie Parker and Eddie Van Halen, but playing accordion, it's just, it makes my head spin. And I'm like, you know, to the point where I'm like, I don't know if I can really hold company with this guy or, you know, find my way out of a paper bag or whatever the terminology would be, but sort of rambling. But the instrumental side of it was like with this vocal, I was kind of agonizing with this track that Danny plays drums on. I sort of tricked him into playing drums. No, it was good. He's all good. It was like, but anyway, so it was like, and I was really struggling with that, going like, does it need lyrics? Because I really was happy with what I'd done. And then like I sort of played it for Angus and he's like, yeah, I reckon lyrics could probably be good. I'm like, ah, oh, dude, you don't even know what a dagger through my heart this is. And what it's like almost like back to the drawing board of like trying to come up with some lyrics for this thing. Cause it's very much, I'm very much more kind of melody driven, but you know, but anyway, so like I'm in this sort of dilemma of trying to, you know, kind of get this thing up and running. And so when I heard Billy Gould kind of mention, and you guys were talking about like, yeah, some of the most evocative music is doesn't have any lyrics to it. And and what an interesting kind of like conundrum. And then it makes me think even of like somebody like David Byrne from Talking Heads, where he, in his amazing book, How Music Works, where he was talking about like, you know, or he's like, lyrics are just a way to trick the listener into listening to the music longer. And I was like, that is so perfect. You know, it's just like,
you could always go like the route of like the Cocteau Twins,
right?
Or like there's this blues song. I have this blues set. It's the Ann Arbor Blues Festival, 1969, and there's one track on there by a bluesman, and I believe he's singing in French, and it's just heartaching. I have no idea what he's saying, and I don't want to Google the lyrics because I know I'll be disappointed. It'll never match what I've already made it mean. Right. So you don't even have to go in English.
It is a strange thing.
Yeah
Well, that's, I know it's funny because I was doing a lot of these we are syllables, and then I was listening back to it, Nate, and kind of like having almost like an existential like, oh, this is horrible. People are going to be like so kind of clowning on this of like, what is up with this, you know, like I knew Bear couldn't write lyrics, but this is just anyway. And then I was like, and then I was talking to one of my kids about it, and he's like well, we are, he's like you're saying yes in German and French. And I'm like, oh yeah, it's like, maybe that's what it is. I was kind of like going like, maybe that's what the song is going to be. This really affirmational kind of thing, you know, like, and I'm just trying to like find these justifications for these goofy syllables that came out that I was just like, oh, that'll do. That's in tune. It's got that nice melody I was trying to do. And there it is. And then realizing like, oh no, have I been spending weeks on this and it's still just in the demo kind of stages of this and not wanting to kind of have to go back. It's maybe, you know, and so just, you know, cause my sort of, one of my crimes is that in recent years past, I would just work up something on a long weekend, or, you know, that's like with these Easter Bear 1 and 2, it's like, it has everything to do with like, I wrote these during like an Easter long weekend where I didn't have to be at my day job and I had a free day of recording, and I'm like, oh, I'll just do this. And then, so it's like, I'm trying to do like a timestamp on it. So that's where those titles come from. It's like, it reminding me of like where I was. In fact, Atlas Face used to be called Australia Day because that's when I came up with this little chord, these little whatever chords on a long weekend. And I worked up a demo and it was like, it was called Australia Day. And it was just like, that's kind of goofy. And then there's all this kind of problematic associations with like the native Australians, you know, and then what it represented. And I'm like, it's not going to be called that. So then Atlas Face was always a nickname we had for Danny Heifetz, because he's such a lover of cartography, and he was always, you know, pre GPS, pre whatever, Google Maps and whatever. He'd be on in the front of the, you know, in the van on these tours with some, this, you know, these maps and kind of helping us figure out where to go and whatever. And he's, you know, so we refer to him as Atlas Face because his face is always buried in like some kind of atlas or some map of some kind or whatever. So
I think it's really interesting how both you and Danny ended up in Australia. Did he arrive because of you partly, or was it two totally separate stories that just happened to be in the same
place? God, I wish I had a good, I just so wanted to riff and be like, you know, Danny felt really bad. He's like, I wonder if Bear's lonely over there. So he's like, I think I'll just move my, no. He met his wife when, I think it was when we were, I think he met her through when we were booking. He had a lot to do with the booking of the first Australian tour that we did in 96. And I think he was probably sweet talking her over the phone or charming her over the phone, mm-hmm. you know, again, this long distance kind of thing and da 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 da. And then, so he met his wife probably through that. So he was, you know, he's still married and whatever. They have a daughter who's like a little bit, I think, younger than my younger kid. Mm. Anyway, so it was almost a fluke in a way. It was kind of funny. It was like, but we were definitely, you know, just, I don't know, charmed.
Which one of you moved here first?
I love the way you, which one of you moved here first? Tell me. I'm yeah. like, no,
who's
I didn't.
The leader?
I promise who's... I wouldn't tell. Well, I think he did. I think, okay. I could be wrong about that, but I think, yeah, he was definitely sort of established and like over here before I was. We sort of came in here a little bit as an afterthought. I mean, it was more like it was just after 9/11 and we were, you know, sort of doing it rough over there in California. Mm. I was just doing some random day job, non-music related. And then, you know, she wasn't really impressed with all the American flags all over all the big trucks. And then just like, you know, getting assistance, whether it's whatever wealth, you know, like the center, the sort of the dole over here is much easier and more kind of like is more humanely set up or whatever. And so if you're sort of doing it rough as a young struggling family, yeah, it's just everything Australia sort of appealed to us more, mm-hmm. in the wake of the 9/11 and the kind of the warmongering and all this, you know, chaos that was going on at the time. So when we came in here, I think it was like latter half of 2002, I think, when we got here. Mm-hmm. So it was just, we couldn't get here quick enough, and it was just like such a better situation as soon as we got here. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Danny was definitely established here first. Sorry.
Okay. All right. So he's the dominant one.
I just follow my life where it sort of plops me and I'm like, oh, I guess I live in Australia now.
Well, you know what? Whenever I meet another American, it's within about 5 minutes, we're talking about Mexican food. Because that's the one thing that I found you can't get here.
You can't get good salsa.
You can't get good salsa. You can't get Monterey Jack cheese.
Right.
They fuck things up. They put carrots in it. They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
I get everything here. Reese's now, I'm satisfied, but no Mexican food.
And those huge burritos that you could buy, and they would like, you can buy one for lunch and you're like, I'll just have the other half for dinner. It's like, it's like $4. I remember these $4 burritos that were just ginormous, and you're just like, oh, it was so good. Oh, if you do meet an American, I made the mistake of presuming a Canadian was an American. I was like, hey, whoa. I was like, hey, you from California? And they're like, and they were some Canadian, and I was just like, oh, and I learned very quickly to always presume, yeah, like Canadian. I mean, I can hear it. It's funny, after all these years of being here, I can hear, like, I can take like a South African versus a Kiwi versus, you know, I can pick it so much better now. My ear's more attuned to it. You know, people are always saying like, yeah, but you haven't lost your American accent. I'm like, yeah, I was 30 when I got here. That's pretty well kind, yeah, of like lodged in there. But there's certain words that I say kind of without irony that are Australian kind of pronunciations that I didn't realize were, I was saying like in the Australian way.
I can tell what words my kids learned from me and which one they've learned at school.
Yeah, like, exactly.
One time my son came home, he's like, oh, Dad, you should have seen it. So-and-so was on the playground and he got kicked in the balls.
The balls.
Balls. Oh, okay. So you learned that word on the schoolyard. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. My kids as well. Like, I remember when reading story time with the kids or whatever, when they were much younger, it was like, I'd always try to soften it. And I know they were probably like looking at me like, what are you doing right now? Like, do you know that's not your your native kind of thing? And I was, cause I didn't want it, you know, and I was always, I knew it was such kind of great value to, for them, for my, you know, Californian family to hear them speak with those beautiful Aussie accents, you know, that's those softer kind of things. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really funny. How many kids do you have?
Two. They're two boys, and one is 11, and the other's turning 14 tomorrow.
Oh, wow, wow.
So, yeah.
Happy birthday to the elder.
It's getting really complex.
Yeah. Oh, my heart goes out to them, though, like having to deal with this, like the distanced thing, man. Like, you know, for kids having to do the Zoom stuff, man, this is brutal. And then my younger kid had a moment with kind of a depression, you know, early in this pandemic where I was just like, oh man, you almost wanted to say, look, just break some rules. I don't know. We kind of got through it, but it got a little bit kind of scary there for a minute.
Well, especially in Melbourne, you guys had it like really bad. You guys were locked down for 3+ months?
Yeah. And it is only kind of easing just a little bit in recent days, a little bit. And there's so much fear kind of like wrapped up with, oh man, you're going to get these fines and this and that, you know? And yeah, it's not been great, but it's seemingly getting better, you know, knock on wood just recently. So hopefully, but it's so strange that I it's weird. Like I've had moments where I'm like, man, am I in like kind of a low level depression with this thing? But then also, you know, and I remember like feeling like, oh wow, there's no FOMO now. There's no kind of like, you know, usually you're sitting, you're like stuck in your thing, like, oh man, it'd be awesome to see that Tool concert or to go and see those shows or this or that. And then it's like, oh, wait a minute. There's like the playing field was suddenly leveled where it's like, there's nowhere to be.
Yeah.
There's like, there's literally nowhere. And I mean, and then I see posters of people that were supposed to be coming out with releases in May or tours that were supposed to be happening in April and May, like under this bridge where I would go play my saxophone just for the beautiful natural reverb. And I'm, you know, living in a small kind of 2-bedroom apartment. I don't want to drive my neighbors to kind of have to break down the door of like, enough saxophone arpeggios. I'm sick of that atonal pattern. Jesus Christ, you're putting it through like 12 keys. I don't give a shit. Like I'm going to fucking, you know, and so I'm trying to spare my neighbors a little bit. And then, yeah, I'd see these posters underneath this bridge, like near the train station. I'm just like, oh, this poor, like, you know, young artist coming out that she can't be like, I'm on my world tour. 2020 was the year for me. And this is like, you imagine like these artists that are just, oh my God, it's heartbreaking to think of people like,
yeah.
Oh no, that world tour, guess what? Not happening. Sorry, wrong year. And there's people thinking like, oh God, I always knew I was cursed, you know? And this is horrible just to think of these people that are trying to do things. And then
During this whole lockdown, actually during this whole year, I've really tried my best to support artists, especially ones that are coming out with records, like because in many ways that's the only lifeline they have at this point. And
right.
But I think that actually this lockdown or the whole, you know, COVID-19, I think that's going to be a renaissance for the local scenes because
awesome.
We're not going to get Foo Fighters here. We're not going to get these stadiums bands anymore. We're not even going to get like the large.
Well, not with that attitude, Nate. I'm certainly not.
I mean, I think there's going to be like, you know, it's going to be the clubs. It's going to be the bands. The local bands are going to be touring around, you know, like I'm thinking
true.
Like bands
and then,
like
then the smaller. I mean, I think that is kind of a running joke as well. I realize I'm probably stealing this from somebody, but I was like, yeah, Umlaut, we were doing like these socially distanced gigs with nobody in the room way before it was cool. You know, and I think we're definitely guilty of that, you know, but it's only because our fans are so discerning and they've got such a keen, like, they're like, yeah, we don't just listen to any bands. We want to listen to bands that don't really have a vocalist, and then they kind of like veer off and I don't really like it that much. Maybe that's terrible, but yeah, that's awesome that you kind of, you know, reach out to us when you saw that we were putting out this 45 and it's just, it really is cool that you're as supportive as you are with doing this. And I like, I was just even kind of charmed to see this the other day. I was at Jeans and she were like listening to the 45. It's just a very cool thing.
Dude.
You know, awesome. Yeah.
How many of these are you getting pressed? How many do you know?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's hard to say. It's like, I don't even know. God, I'm terrible. I'll have to scold Gene harshly. You didn't tell me how many.
Now, this is the Easter Bear. The songs are from the EP Arunachala.
Yeah, Arunachala from, I think, a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So this is the first time on vinyl then?
Well, for this, but we had, we put out the, what was it? The second one? Oh my God. I think I might have, no, it's I think it was the second Umla albums was also on like vinyl. It was but definitely. Yeah. That one's actually sold out, unfortunately.
That's To Your Poverty Quietly Go.
Right. Yeah. And that was Joe Talia, amazing musician and producer, engineer, recorded that for us, and I think did a fantastic job.
Now, obviously, there's a Bungle reunion in the news. Did you know about the Bungle reunion as it was happening before anyone else?
Wait, a Bungle what? Did you say a Bungle reunion?
A Bungle reunion, yes.
Wait, what is this? I hadn't heard of this. Sorry, I had to have a try. We did know. Danny and I, we did know. And we gave them our blessing. And I just think it's awesome that, you know, those three guys have, grown up a lot and I don't know if bucket list is the right thing, but it's maybe a fantasy of theirs to kind of get, you know, Lombardo and kind of like, you know, reimagine and rewrite their history, you know, like kind of their real kind of origins of what they, what Bungle started as. So that was, you know, I think it was just like, it's that thing, a case of like, can we, you know, what would it be like to do these, to bring this thing? Cause they, you know, the original Raging Wrath was pretty, you know, it's like with anything with cassettes, it's very quickly.
It's lo-fi. It's hard to hear.
And it was, you know, kind of a four track thing. And it was just, it's kind of hard to tell what's going on. So this is really just bringing it into like the modern era in a really 3D way. And, you know, it's pretty cool. I think it's just really great to hear Trey and his insane kind of like insanely fast right hand and Trevor chugging away in there. And Mike just sounds really strong and, and it's just really cool. Yeah, Danny and I did know about it, but we're kind of like trying to keep things a bit like mysterious, I guess.
Yeah.
About it. So, but it's funny because I did sort of toy with almost trolling the band and kind of going like, I just always have such a goofy kind of thing that I wanted to do like these slow motion montages of me like working out and like this like black and white kind of thing of like, I'm not okay with this. I'm really pissed off. And just to kind of mess with people a little bit and be like, wow, Bear's really bent about this thing, man. And like, and then even the idea of like, you know, hey guys, come on, man. I got my saxophone. I just want to, let me go blaze one solo, guys. I mean, I'll even get like some effects pedals and whatever. I mean, you won't even recognize it as a saxophone. I mean, fuck saxophones. Am I right? So come on, guys. And then them just not like returning my calls. And then like, oh God, he wants to fucking be involved in this. And it's not for this music, but no, anyway, yeah. So it's, but I, of course,
you know, what you need to do is get there out, get the new album and then just release your own version of that with you playing sax over it.
You know, I've been wanting to, or do some videos of like doing the Chili Peppers under the bridge, play the melody, you know, like actually on saxophone, just do an instrumental version, actually under the bridge of where I go and play, would go play before, you know, pre-pandemic kind of thing, playing that, you know, for people that, but anyway, no, I haven't done any of that, but it's
good to see him like after so many years, because there was always such lore around Bungle.
Right.
It seemed like it was really quiet on the Bungle front. I mean, was the silence on the topic somewhat coordinated?
It wasn't really coordinated, and it wasn't that people didn't want to talk about it. I think it's just the way it went. And you know, those are prolific boys, you know, those guys, they've got a lot to do, and they're not sitting there doing a lot of what ifs with, you know, they just do music. They just had a bunch of other outlets for it. And then it got a little old having to hear this, like, so man, what are you guys gonna, you know, I'm sure Mike is well tired of that question, as Trevor and Trey a little bit, you know, like, so there was probably a little bit of a fatigue that came up with it as well, where people were just kind of like living their lives and doing their own things and, you know, very fulfilled in those other areas in a lot of ways. Mm. You know, I think it was a little bit of fatigue. I don't know if it's really coordinated so much Yeah, that's because again, it's like because it's even with the idea of like, were you guys really planning on doing this? Like, nah, it's kind of what came out, and then maybe you know you sort of look back and you say like, oh wow, there seems to be a pattern here, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've always told you know Bungle people that have gotten in contact or fans that have gotten in contact with me that man, I sort of keep a special flame burning for that group of guys, and I always, you know, I'm staying healthy, man, and I'm trying to keep my chops together, so that's about as much as I can say. But you know, but it's you sort of try to keep a little bit of something going, but there's no sort of like concrete plans for having my saxophone blazing over those thrash fucking riffs, man. Anyway.
Well, I got to tell you, I really am enjoying the records that I have of Umlaut. I've got To Your Poverty Quietly Go, which you graciously decorated for me. Thank you for that.
Oh, thanks.
And the single, which you've sent me a test pressing. Do you want this back? I was going to get another one. Do you need the test pressing back?
No, man. Well, I would hope that you would absolutely, you know, take that as a token of our gratitude for
absolutely
helping promote us out here and keep the word out there. You know, that's we're honored.
Oh man, this is great. I mean, having a test pressing, as you know, test pressings are always some of the most precious, sought after records out of the bunch. So
does it say Umlaut on it without the U?
Umlaut, yes. I think they misspelled it.
That gives it an extra little, little talking point. It's funny. Really quickly with my sad story with vinyl that I was thinking to tell had to do with the first Mr. Bungle like picture disc, which is, I'm sure you might be aware of, is like, has all the, from the, like the crazy artwork on there, and then I think the clown face from the album cover on the other side.
Yeah,
and I actually, as my ex-wife was very angry with me at the time, but I actually sold it when we were like a young starving family, and starving is probably dressing it up a little bit, but I was just like, oh, you know, I remember I was selling all these CDs off, and like, and I was so kind of like, we were so hard up or whatever at that point that I sold my picture disc because we were, you know, just, and it's just, it's one of these things where you're like, oh. And I remember she, even at the time, she's like, maybe one of your kids would have wanted to inherit that or something. I was like, it was this whole thing. And I was just like, but we need the money. And so I sold my picture disc to feed my family. And ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back after these. No, anyway, so it's a sad story, but that was one of the things that came up for me to share. Mm-hmm. And maybe your listeners are like, oh, you know what? F this guy, man. If that's what he's going to do. I mean, you know, I don't know. It's just like one of those.
That's all right. Hey, you know, look, there's no sense in looking at past decisions and trying to revisit them. You're not going to change them anyway. And
no, I know. I just thought it was kind of an interesting little story to tell as far as the concerns vinyl. And then, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of collectors would have been like, oh, this jackass. Or maybe there's a listener out there going like, yeah, I was the guy who bought the thing off of you, you dipshit.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to send you a vinyl copy of Disco Volante.
What?
I will send you a copy of that. You sent me this test pressing. I'll send you a copy of Disco Volante.
Oh, that's all right. For you. That's amazing.
And maybe one day you'll have a record player set up and you can play. Do you have a
player? Oh, man. I don't have a record player, but my girlfriend does. I mean, it's one of these things I've got to do the thing, man. I've got it because it really is. It's just the
slippery slope, man. Be careful.
You know, the guy that played drums on the Kintsugi actually played on Arunachala as well. This guy, Hudson Whitlock, our drummer at the time, he's an avid collector, and he has like some groups here locally, the Cactus Channel, Proteins. I'm sure he does other things. He's a great drummer, great musician, and he is an avid collector. And he's always going like, oh, Bear, check this out. He pulls the thing lovingly out of the sleeve and puts it on. And I'm just like, oh, man. And it's so amazing, you know, like the amount of amazing music that I've been exposed to, like via like vinyl, that I'm just like, anyway, there's really kind of no excuse, but I was sort of like, it's one of those kind of panic things where I'm like, it's such a high bar to like, I'd have like 10 vinyls or something. And people like, well, I've got like 500. Another person's like, I've got 5,000. And I just always felt like it was kind of such a steep learning curve. And thing to kind of catch up with that I just sort of let myself off the hook with. That it's kind of like maybe people that certain people that haven't seen Game of Thrones and then other people that swear by it, and I'm one of the people that never got around to watching it. Probably shouldn't out myself that way, but it was like I was just like, oh man, it seems like a lot of episodes are gonna
Me neither. So I haven't seen one episode of that. You know what, I've never seen The Wizard of Oz, and I keep saying, you know what, I made it this far, I'm gonna go the rest of the way. I'm never gonna see Wizard of Oz. Never. Fuck
you.
It. No way. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's now, funny,
now
but I guess
now it's a principle.
Fair enough.
All right. So, Bear, here's what we're going to do. Come November 6th, which is going to be Bandcamp Friday, This record, The Easter Bear, is going to be up on umlautbyermckinnon.bandcamp.com. Yep. And I'm going to post this URL. And we're going to do our damnedest to sell as many of these records as we can because we're vinyl maniacs. And Bandcamp Friday is a day where all the proceeds go to the artist, right? Uh-huh. Bandcamp steps aside and gives 100% to the artist. So that's the day to do it. It's not bad to buy a record any other day, but it's even better on Bandcamp Friday. So Friday, November 6th, everyone go to umlautbyermckinnon.bandcamp.com. Pick up a copy of The Easter Bear. This is a 7-inch. I'm sure it's very limited numbers, and I'm sure it's going to be beautiful because it's pressed at Zenith Records in Melbourne, who are known for doing these amazing pressings. Now, I've got a test pressing. I've played it several times. It sounds beautiful, and I'm sure the final product is going to not only sound beautiful but look beautiful as well. And maybe even umlaut is going to be spelled correctly on the label. So, so anyway, that is the goal, everyone. umlautbyermckinnon.bandcamp.com. Pick up a copy of The Easter Bear. And Bear, again, thanks so much for coming on the show. And
thank you, man.
As soon as these lockdowns end, I need to go down to Melbourne anyway. I got to visit some people and hang out and check in on them. And then let's definitely connect and maybe we'll listen to some records.
That's awesome, man. Sounds great. Thanks so much.
There we go, Mr. Umlaut Bear McKinnon. November 6th, umlautbearmckinnon.bandcamp.com. Grab a copy of this new 7-inch single available there. Extremely limited quantities. I believe it's maybe 100-150. Very limited, so get in quick. That's November 6th, umlautbearmckinnon.bandcamp.com. And don't forget, there's an extended version of this interview up on our patreon.com/vinylguide site. Become a member of our Patreon team and get access to heaps of extended interviews, secret episodes, extra content, and much, much more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. Go up there now, help support this show, and get all those extras. That's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Please share this episode across your social medias, your Facebooks, your Instagrams, your Tweeters on Twitter. All that stuff is a huge help. Also, make sure your friends know how to subscribe to a podcast. If you got record nerd friends and they don't exactly know how to get a podcast, that's understandable. It's not always straightforward. Help them out. Work with them on their smartphone. Let them know how to get this podcast. Subscribe for them and encourage them to enjoy the Vinyl Guide podcast. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.